the week of November 11th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 170, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Giltz, Michael Giltz.
Ooh, I see what you're doing there. I think you're trying to be like one of those characters from that spy movie.
James Bond, don't pretend you don't know what we're talking about.
Okay, well, you know, actually, we're back. We were off last week. We're going to be off next week for Thanksgiving.
It's his fault.
Yes, it's my fault. But we are back, kind of like another entity is back. And in fact, I think we should have started today's episode of Showbiz Sandbox like this. Okay, I better stop it right there so that we don't get in trouble.
Right. Obviously, that was big news that we missed 2 weeks ago while we were off about Lucasfilm. But what else are we going to talk about this week?
Oh, well, you know, since we were off last week, we have a lot of news to catch up on. Disney, as we just kind of hinted at, they went shopping again. And they went shopping for name brand properties. And this time, they came home with a little company called Lucasfilm. And, you know, they only plunked down $4 billion for it, so hopefully it'll turn a profit for them. There's some good news for newspapers. Circulation is on the rise, at least for some of them. Even the streaming music service Spotify, we don't talk about them enough, they seem to be headed in the right direction, i.e. towards a profit. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll be joined by our former co-host, Karen Woodward.
Yay!
Yeah, that's right. Stopping by to help us cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire who is still drying out from Hurricane Sandy, Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world, because, of course, we total the box office in North America and every other country we can get our hands on, is the James Bond film Skyfall. It finally opened in the U.S. after two weekends overseas. It grossed $177 million worldwide. It's at over $600 million worldwide to date. In the U.S., it grossed $87-88 million. If you throw in Thursday's numbers, where it was on an exclusive IMAX showing, that's $90 million for its four-day opening weekend. I even sent Sperling a text saying that the estimates that the movie would gross about $75 million seemed low to me, and that I was gunning for $90 million, and I crazily thought maybe even $100 million. But I thought, you know, this movie would hit $90 million, and it came just about there. So I guess I did better this week than all the box office prognosticators.
Well, and it helped that you saw the movie 400 times just to get it over the line.
Well, that's true. But I think there's a lot of reasons for it. It's... you know, the best reviewed Bond film in ages. It'd been a few weeks since we'd had a big action film. Taken 2, I think, would be the most recent. There'd been a good gap between Bond films, so demand was ready to build. They had Judi Dench there for women. Daniel Craig appeals to women, so it wasn't just a guy-oriented movie. It had a little more of a substance to it, a little more of a story. And, of course, it's Bond. And I think if you look back over the years, it's always kind of underperformed in the last decade or two as far as opening weekend and total box office. The last few movies have set Bond records, but as we know, no Bond film has ever grossed $200 million in North America. No Bond film has ever, you know, reached certain levels that this film could hit $1 billion. It's going to hit $800 million without breaking a sweat. It's going to be by far the top grossing Bond film of all time, not adjusting for inflation, as Sperling is about to say, because of those movies in the early 60s were extremely popular.
I know. Think about it. This is a 50-year-old franchise that is still going strong. In fact, it's so old that, how old is it? You see, you're supposed to, you know, help me out here.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. In any case, it's so old that the older male audiences is what helped push the gross up higher. 75% of the audience were older males, ages 25 or higher.
Wow, this is already the highest grossing Bond film worldwide in history.
Okay, well, and
Quantum of Solace grossed 590. I'm sorry, Casino Royale was at 596, and Quantum was at $591 million worldwide. And this is already over $600 million. And of course, it just opened in North America, so that's a record. It set an opening weekend record. It's clearly going to break $200 million in the U.S., so it should break the record of $169 million for Bond in the U.S. All those numbers, of course, are not adjusted for inflation. It's just a, you know, I think it's always been a blockbuster franchise. And if you adjust for inflation, you can see in the early 60s how huge a hit it was. But I think now they have turned this ongoing, steady, regular, you know, movie franchise into a real blockbuster.
Well, you know, it took them 25 films to get it right. But, you know, I think you're right. I think it's going to be a success.
More than half the tickets sold in North America were for Skyfall.
That's absolutely astounding. Literally more than half of the tickets sold in both the U.S. and Canada. That just is astounding to me.
Yeah, it got great reviews, probably as good as Casino Royale. Certainly one of the best reviewed Bond films ever. I don't know how you can quantify that exactly, but it's certainly right up there as far as best reviewed Bond film. Well, which doesn't really matter that much if you look at the Roger Moore era.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's just really a record setter in so many ways. But there's, of course, a lot of other movies that came out in last week and this week, so let's get to them. At number two around the world is Wreck-It Ralph, which grossed $44 million. It's at $120 million worldwide and counting. It's doing very well in North America and just started opening up overseas. It opened last weekend here. This weekend, it's now at about $100 million in the U.S. alone. So that's a very strong release from Disney. It's a non-Pixar animated film. So that and Tangled are showing that Disney's non-Pixar movies are really back in form after a few years where they were floundering. At number three around the world is Argo, which grossed $18 million. That's $113 million and counting. At number four is the Denzel Washington drama Flight, which I did not like. It grossed $15 million worldwide. It's at $47 million to date. It's basically open in North America only.
What do you think of the first 15 minutes of that film, though? That was a harrowing first 15 minutes.
Actually, no, the first 15 minutes begins with his day before he goes onto the flight. Everybody knows, I think, that it's about a plane crash.
Right.
And aftermath.
Right.
And the first 15 minutes are actually kind of banal as we cut between him and this drug addict woman who, you know, I wonder if their paths will cross. It's one of the many reasons I don't like the film. But then, yes, the flight and the actual crash are very well done. Not quite up to the standards of Fearless, starring Jeff Bridges. That, I think, is the greatest flight crash in history, but it's very effective and well done. I just found the movie very TV movie-ish. Denzel is good. He usually is. He's solid here, but it's just not that interesting a film. Argo, however, very similar movie geared towards adults, I think is much better.
What about Alive? Alive had a great plane crash in it. Not that any plane crash is great, but you know, it was certainly covered very well in the film in terms of the way it was shot.
It's a movie. You're not saying people plane crashes are good. We all understand. I never saw Alive, but maybe someday soon we can do a list of our favorite plane crashes in the movies.
Well, you want to talk about a harrowing movie. I saw The Impossible this past week, and boy, is that a hard... It's a very good movie, and I would, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm just saying that watching a movie about the Southeast Asian tsunami, with that degree of reality, I mean, it was hard to watch.
Is it a spectacle film to a degree? I know there's a family drama at the heart of it, but is it going to have the appeal of like The Day After and those disaster picks where it has
not at all
harrowing, memorable tsunami? No?
No, it's very realistic.
Well, but that's great. If you see the movie and think, oh my God, that's exactly like it was, is it a spectacle? Is it where you go, oh my God, it's like watching the Titanic sink, watching the tsunami strike or a hurricane or an earthquake. If you watch it and go, oh my God, that must have been what it was like a little bit. That sounds very appealing to me in a voyeuristic, spectacle sort of way.
Then if that's the way you're judging it, absolutely, yes, it will definitely be. It's very voyeuristic because it really does. I mean, you're watching this scene unfold, this event unfold, and all. I mean, you're feeling the pain as they get, you know.
Right. So this is a tragedy. It's obviously like the perfect storm where that you know people in real life suffered, and it's a terrible thing. But people do go to the movies sometimes to see these reenactments of real life disasters of massive events, and if they did that well, that's interesting. That's the Spanish film starring Ewan McGregor and who is it?
Naomi Watts.
It's been opened in Spain and doing very well there. It's not on our charts this week, but it's still doing strongly. But again, we have Skyfall, Wreck-It Ralph, Argo, and Flight. Now at number five, we have Cloud Atlas. That grossed another $11 million worldwide. It's at $33 million and counting. It did have a good opening in, I want to say, Russia? I forget where it had a good opening.
Antarctica.
It did have a good opening in one country where it did pretty well, but essentially this movie is not performing up to task. And number six is a Korean film. It's called A Werewolf Boy, aka Nyokade Sonyun, which I think is their version of Teen Wolf, basically. It's not, instead of a comedy, it's a romantic drama. It opened in Korea, South Korea, last week, and it did huge blockbuster business. It made $10 million this weekend in South Korea alone. It's at $23 million and counting, so I can imagine that the U.S. remake is in the works.
You know, we're going to have to rename this segment. Instead of box office, we're going to call it Michael Giltz Tries to Pronounce the title of a foreign film.
And fails. And number seven is a two-way tie, two movies that grossed $8 million, Paranormal Activity 4, which is at $130 million worldwide, and Taken 2, the Liam Neeson film, it's at $350 million worldwide. And number nine is the Kevin James comedy, Here Comes the Boom, that grossed $6 million. It's at $43 million and counting, not doing well. And number 10 is the European-only release Asterisk and Obelix in 3D, At Service to Your Majesty. It grossed $5 million in France, and it's at $31 million and counting. And at number 11, Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, it still keeps chugging along. It's at another $4 million, and it grossed $735 million worldwide to date.
Yeah, you know, Madagascar 3, and there was another animated film that I'm forgetting, Ice Age, Continental Drift. These are films that helped the Russian box office surpass the $1 billion U.S. dollar mark 2 weeks earlier than it did in 2011. I guess in 2011, it was November 2nd is when that market surpassed the billion-dollar mark. And now, according to Exhibitors Bulletin out of Russia, it was October 21st that the market surpassed $1 billion in box office sales.
For a long time, Japan was the biggest overseas market. Japan would have huge numbers, way outside of the size of their population. Japan was just a big film market. And of course, in recent years, we've seen China and Russia popping up on our lists as we cover the international box office. So it's no surprise to know that Russia is a very big market. It's been growing a lot. There's a lot of multiplexing, I'm sure, in the country, and that's helping. China is coming on board. More and more movies are being released there. And so those figures and those growth, there's just a lot more room to grow. Look at India, look at South America, Africa. The international box office for big Hollywood movies is only getting bigger. And of course, they'll all be looking forward to movies from people like Steven Spielberg. His movies are worldwide hits, no matter what he makes.
Is he still making movies? I thought he retired.
No, and Lincoln, that's Soderbergh, Steven Soderbergh.
Oh, I knew one of the Stevens had retired.
So Lincoln was the big independent film release. I should say the big limited film release is what I'm trying to say. It opened on just 11 screens and it grossed $81,000 per screen. So it made almost $1 million on this very limited release. So that's a very strong beginning for that film. We'll have to see how it does when it expands.
Hey, here's a figure for you. 67% of those who saw the picture this weekend were over the age of 35.
Lincoln?
Lincoln, yes.
Doesn't surprise me. I guess it's a film for adults.
Well, I mean, I guess you can't say, well, you know, I knew Lincoln. I'm going to go see the movie, you know, so you don't have any of Lincoln's contemporaries ready to go see the film.
Here's another number that'll surprise you. $45 million. That's the amount of money that Heineken paid to have James Bond drink their beer in the new film. He also drinks martinis. Don't be upset. They're shaken, not stirred. But he does drink a Heineken. I don't actually remember it, but he does. They paid $45 million for that to happen. $45 million. The estimates for this film range from $150 to $200 million. Bond has always had major endorsements and tie-ins. They've always worked it hard.
Well, with the cars especially.
Cars. The clothes, Tom Ford makes his clothes. They've always worked very hard on all their endorsement deals. You see James Bond in ads, and they do it without somehow tarnishing it or making the movie cheaper. They've done a good job of doing quality tie-ins to the film. Obviously, it's a luxury high-end market that people are going for if they want to advertise with James Bond. $45 million, though, that's a third to a quarter of the entire budget of this major blockbuster film. Is it possible that they've paid off half of his budget or more simply with endorsement deals?
Well, you know, I actually saw, you know, here in the U.S., there's a commercial with James Bond or Daniel Craig playing a character like James Bond, although he's never called Bond, and he's got a Heineken. And I thought, why is Daniel Craig doing this ad? Well, now I know why.
That's a time with Heineken. So I'd be fascinated to know exactly how many deals they've done and how much of the current movie's budget they were able to lay off before they even shot a frame of film. But you won't get to see a frame of film in China.
No, that's for sure, yeah.
James Bond's Skyfall has been delayed. It was supposed to come out soon.
November 2nd, it was supposed to come out already.
But China said, you know what? We're a little worried this is going to be yet another big Hollywood blockbuster. We're going to release it in 2013 because they want to make sure their local movies are protected. They, in fact, named a month, I think it was July, was like local film month, where they wouldn't release any international films so that their big productions would have the best chance of scoring at the box office. They'd have 3 or 4 weeks of, you know, free reign. Like no Spawn, no Pixar, no Armageddon, no anything that they would have to face from Hollywood or other overseas companies. So they've done it again. They've pushed back the release of Bond. So that's an interesting note. I mean, China is opening up more and more, but they're still keeping an eye on their own market.
Well, yeah, and this is why Iron Man 3 is now a co-production, quote-unquote co-production, with China. And that's because if you're a co-production, then you're considered a Chinese film. You kind of fit under some certain quotas. And what they will do is they'll say, okay, well, we'll open Iron Man 3 this week. Nothing else, just Iron Man 3. And they'll give you like a week or two to play, and then they'll open other movies. Now, I can't remember. I think it was Spider-Man and Batman were not Chinese co-productions and did not give over any of the profits to the Chinese distributors. And there's really only one, the China Film Group in China. And so they opened up against one another.
Well, that's it. Well, they don't release a lot of foreign films and they play games with the release dates. That's clear. So it's getting better, but there's a lot of room for growth. I wonder what the video on demand sales will be for The Amazing Spider-Man, because it has come out on DVD and Blu-ray, and I'm sure it's available on video on demand.
Well, you just might be able to find out now, Michael, because according to the Los Angeles Times, the story in the LA Times, that all this creative accounting that goes on with box office and whether a film makes a profit and whether, you know, those numbers are released at all is, well, according to some, the VOD numbers are becoming a bit more quote unquote transparent. I don't see it, but I guess they wanted to write a story about Arbitrage, this Richard Gere movie, and there's kind of
released in theaters and on video on demand at the same time.
Right. So, both, you know, it was a day and date release with theatrical. And I guess it's made, I'm just looking up here, what is it made? $7.5 million. It sold $7.5 million in tickets. And I'm confused. No, it's made about $11 million in VOD and sold about $7.5 million in tickets.
I don't know why you're saying in tickets. It grossed $11 million in homes on video on demand and about almost $8 million. At the box office.
Okay, maybe it's a better way to say that. Now, Margin Call used to hold that reign of day-and-date release champion. They made $6 million on home video and $5.4 million in theaters.
Well, the LA Times is jumping the gun a bit. Video-on-demand numbers are not becoming more transparent. If any individual company wants to suddenly say, hey, we've had a big success story with Arbitrage or with, what was the other movie?
Margin Call.
They're going to release that numbers and tout them. But in general, you can't find out what a movie's making on video on demand to save your life any more than you can find out what movies are making on DVD and Blu-ray. They hate to release those figures. They'll do it once in a great while, but they don't want to tell people what they're making because for years they were making more on DVD and Blu-ray than they were at the box office. And they knew that if the actors became aware of that, they'd demand a bigger piece of the pie. And they wanted to keep it all for themselves. And so now you have the same thing with video on demand. This movie's making more on video on demand than it is at the box office. Is Richard Gere getting the same cut? He agreed to make this movie for a dime, I'm sure, but I'm sure that it also involves some sort of back end. Did he get a back end of just the box office, or did he get a back end of video on demand as well?
Well, I can tell you this, that if there are back end deals, then Richard Gere's people, his team, will have audit rights, and they can go in and audit the books. Now, that's going to be all on Richard Gere to pay for, so it's very rarely done that occurs, that the talent will go and audit the studio books, but...
True. Usually find mistakes.
Yes, they do.
And when a majority of the money taken in is at video on demand, there's a lot more incentive to do so.
That's right, because it's all electronic and there's ways to track it all.
And he knows what the movie made at the box office. So it's interesting. They're jumping the gun a bit. It's not quite as transparent as one company released figures on one movie. That does not mean a sea change in the industry, but they're making money at video on demand. You look at art house movies, it's extremely common these days that you'll see a movie released in the art house and also on video demand day and date, or even before it comes out at the box office. So, you know, it's a whole new world. It doesn't mean you're going to see big Hollywood movies doing that anytime soon, but you do see that with art house films.
And I thought it was interesting the way Lionsgate said that, you know, 90% of those going to see Arbitrage in theaters had absolutely no idea that it was available VOD.
They're saying they did a bad job?
I guess. I don't know. Just to put it all in perspective, The Hangover, the first film, it earned $34 million on VOD alone. So that's not counting DVD and home video. That's just VOD.
That's good money.
That is. Yeah, but that's also kind of, an outlier. But look, it used to be that VOD was seen as kind of like a direct-to-DVD title. It was the bastard stepchild of having a theatrical release. But I guess what the Los Angeles Times is saying here is not anymore. Now it's a way to maybe, you know, capitalize on all of the marketing being done for the theatrical release to also have it released on iTunes or Amazon and ways that people can view it at home who might not be able to get to the theater or it's not playing in their area.
is there a difference between video on demand and pay-per-view?
They're both the same thing.
Right. Isn't it? So any numbers, I mean, it's a different term for the same action, right?
Correct. Yes.
So why would anybody think pay-per-view was pathetic or lame? Or what? It's like it's just another way of getting people to pay to watch a movie.
Well, effectively, if you went straight to VOD and didn't have a theatrical release, you were seen as not good enough for a theatrical release. Well,
duh, of course. Nobody's talking about that. If you went straight to DVD, you're lame. If you go straight to VHS, if you go straight to cable and never play a theater, everybody knows that. But that's not the issue. That's not what made video on demand lesser. They just don't want to talk about the numbers.
So then let me ask you this. Do you think Barry Levinson, the film director, whose movie The Bay will open both in theaters and on VOD next week, he believes that the numbers, VOD numbers, that is, would be at, will be as commonplace as television ratings and box office grosses are today. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely not, because we've had 20 years with VHS or 30 years with VHS and DVDs, and they still refuse to release the grosses. We don't know what movies make on DVD and VHS. We don't know what they make on rental. We can find out at the end of the year. You can sometimes get a rough estimate.
No, rental, they actually do publish. RentTrack publishes that. Rental, that is.
Because it's out of the studio's control.
Probably, yes, because they can go straight to the stores and straight to the providers, the rental providers.
I think that video on demand numbers have become as common as box office gross is silly. They've never released them for DVDs. They fight tooth and nail to keep that information private. So I don't see, if I had my druthers, the studios would just have a number for that week. What did our movie make this week? I don't care if it's at the box office, on DVD, on video on demand, on digital streaming, on rental, on whatever. I don't care. You would have home video movies being released to DVD. Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man, would be up in the top 10 this week because it just got released on DVD. It might gross more money than Skyfall. Not in this day and age, but in times past, it would certainly be in the top 5. Spider-Man would suddenly make another $22 million, in money.
Well, I wonder if RentTrack can do an end run around the studios and basically go to the VOD providers and say, look, we want your sales figures for the weekend or for the week, and we'll tally them all up, and we'll go to Time Warner and Comcast and whoever has the VOD numbers. We'll add it all up and we'll publish that. Now, I'm sure the VOD providers, it's against some contract clause for them to do so, but it's a lot easier to do that than one would think.
Yeah, well, if they could, they would.
Who knows? Maybe it's happening.
Well, so there we go. I think Barry Levinson is wrong. Was Disney right to buy Lucasfilm? Because that's the biggest news I think we missed last week.
Well, yeah, of course, it came out just as we were finishing post-production on last week's episode. So thank you very much, Mr. Iger, CEO of Disney, for not announcing that earlier in the week or, say, on a Sunday. Thank you very much. I'm actually now quite upset with Mr. Iger because I'm kidding, of course. And were they right? Was Disney right to buy Lucasfilm? Let me think about that for half a second. Yeah, they were right.
Well, I mean, it depends how much they paid for and in what way. They paid $4 billion for Lucasfilm. It's not like if they paid $5 trillion, it would be a smart deal.
Well, yeah, true. Yeah.
$4 billion is a lot of money. But they didn't just buy a library of titles. They bought the ability and right to start making new Star Wars movies.
That's
and
right.
In fact, like James Bond, they want to turn this puppy into a franchise, or more likely the Avengers. They want to say, hey, we've got the Marvel Universe. Now we've got the Star Wars Universe. You can be certain we're going to see a Boba Fett movie sometime down the road. But to start off, they're going to make the fabled, legendary episodes 7, 8, and 9. George Lucas always conceived Star Wars as a 9-part, series. He filmed parts 3, 4, and 5. Then we saw 1, 2, and 3, and he told us, that's it. I'm done. It's only about Darth Vader. But now, of course, we know that they're making parts 7, 8, and 9. They've already got a release date. God forbid. They don't have a script yet, but of course they've picked a release date because that's so smart. But they have a release date of 2015. They have a screenwriter, John Arndt, who worked on Toy Story 3.
No, Michael Arndt.
Michael Arndt, I beg your pardon, who worked on Toy Story 3 and won an Oscar for Little Miss Sunshine. So they've got a good writer. He's written treatments, I think, for at least part 7 and I think maybe 8 and 9. That was part of the whole deal. They've been working on it for a while. So they've got a treatment in mind. They're reaching out to directors. They're going to start casting. They get to make new Star Wars movies. So if you think 7, 8, and 9 are each going to be worth, what do they make at the box office? A conservative $700, $800 million worldwide?
Easily, well, at the box office. And then, of course, you can turn around and you're selling toys and they're at the theme parks. I mean, it's it's easy to see why Disney bought them and how they're going to capitalize on some or exploit some of those quote-unquote properties or products.
Right. Eventually, of course, they have to let certain deals expire. And then they can pull things into the fold, as with, you know, Marvel. They have to wait for Spider-Man to expire. Then they can finally pull Spider-Man into the fold, I assume at some point, 10 or 20 years down the road. They, of course, will want, you know, theme park rides. Why not? Those are in some other places. They'll want to pull them out and get them into Disney. TV shows. Lucasfilm has been developing TV shows for quite a while now, talking about launching Star Wars TV shows. They have the hit Star Wars Clone Wars, which is a pretty fun animated series. And they want to do lots of others, live action, TV drama set in the world of the, you know, the Empire, where you're dealing with political intrigue, other TV dramas following this character, or maybe a Jedi Academy, on and on and on. And the possibilities are endless. And when you think about it, this franchise, as far as movies and TV, has been very moribund.
Yeah, you know what I think is very interesting is that, you know, how Twitter and Facebook exploded with this news. Everybody was so excited, and I thought, hey, remember how excited we were about episodes 1, 2, and 3 before they were first released? The good news here is, in my opinion, is that George Lucas will not be directing these films.
He won't be direct. He won't be involved in any way.
Well, he's going to be a creative, you know, consultant
in any way. He's not going to be. He's going to have a title, but he's not going to be producing actively. He's not going to be writing. He's not going to be directing. And the last time that happened was The Empire Strikes Back, the one film that virtually, that's the only time it happened where he didn't write and direct the film. And that is the only film that everybody loves. You know, that and Star Wars are both, you know, ever since Star Wars, that's the only movie that everybody thinks is the best. The one movie that everybody thinks is terrific. He didn't direct it. He didn't write it. It's no coincidence that Empire Strikes Back marked a downturn in quality and that the first two were absolutely horrible.
You mean Return of the Jedi, not Empire Strikes Back.
Sorry, Return of the Jedi, and then the first three films, which were absolutely dreadful in every possible way, he was involved up to his teeth. So yeah, there's actual reason to be happy because George Lucas is letting go. My God, they might even release Star Wars on Blu-ray.
You know, let's put it this way. Now that Disney owns them, absolutely they will be released on Blu-ray. What I think is, if I were over at Disney, I would actually be calling Christopher Nolan right now and saying, hey, you know what you did for Batman? How'd you like to do that for yet another franchise?
Well, you know, I mean, there's lots of big name directors. Spielberg has already taken himself out of the running, but they've got their pick of, you know, it's not always the biggest name directors that you want for a franchise like this. You know, Lucas had success with Irvin Kershner directing Empire Strikes Back. He was certainly not the biggest director in the world at the time. So you don't necessarily always want Quentin Tarantino or Christopher Nolan to direct your franchise movie. But, you know, as you can see, strong, talented directors can make great movies. If they're passionate about it, then, you know, it can work. Joss Whedon was not a big name when he made Marvel's The Avengers.
No, as a matter of fact, I was talking to some executives over at Disney, some in the distribution department, and we were talking about what their 2015 will look like. And they said, look, they're going to have Avengers 2. They're going to have the first Star Wars, you know, Episode 7. They're going to have, and I can't remember the Pixar title that they mentioned, but they basically had 3 or 4 titles that were all conceivably going to make more than $1 billion.
So they're going to have a very good 2015.
I mean, they could literally be 40% of the market that year.
I mean, there is an Avatar world being built for Disney World, an entire world devoted to Avatar. They only have one Avatar movie, for God's sake. You know, a Star Wars land at Disney World? Is that not just a no-brainer?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I wonder if Rupert Murdoch, when he got wind of this, was like, get me somebody at Fox on the line. I want heads to roll.
They have two Pixar films, I think, scheduled for 2015. One of them is in summer, and that's the movie set inside the brain.
Okay.
That they've been developing for a long time. You know, all their movies are kind of unusual and interesting. This is a Pixar movie that goes inside the brain. I'm not sure what it's about, but it's directed by Pete Docter, who's one of the big, you know, talents at Pixar. So that's one of their two big movies for 2015, you know, coming from Pixar. Well, so they have two Pixar films. So, you know, God help everybody else.
That's right. And that everybody else, as I just alluded to, Fox used to release, has released all the Star Wars films, and they're not going to be doing that anymore.
So does Disney need to make any of their own movies anymore? They're almost outsourcing their entire schedule. They have Lucasfilm now. They have Pixar. They have Marvel.
Muppets.
They have DreamWorks Live Action, the Muppets. Jerry Bruckheimer produces live action films for them. It's like they only have to make 2 or 3 movies a year.
Well, and what I thought was Neil Gabler, the author and film, well, he's not a film critic, but more of like a film historian.
Historian, yeah.
He had this whole article in the Los Angeles Times that was really brilliant in how he talked about how movies used to build franchises, used to build brands. They used to make the movie, which helped build a brand. Now, brands are building movie. Like, the movie doesn't matter. The movie is kind of secondary to the brand.
I don't know what you're talking about. Give me an example.
Oh, I knew you were going to say. Well, Avengers is a great example. It doesn't really matter, you know, who's in it or who's playing Iron. Well, Iron Man 2 doesn't really matter. It was not a very good movie, and yet it still does well because it's got a built-in audience and people are going to go see it no matter what critics say.
No, that's not true, because the Hulk movies did not do well.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, no, it that's just asinine comment. Sorry, Neil Gabler.
Well, you should read his piece. It's actually quite good, and I'm not doing it any justice.
I'm sure it's interesting, but it does matter who you cast in these movies. It does matter who directs them. The quality does matter. Yes, you can have certain franchises like Transformers, which are just pure junk and yet make a ton of money. That happens. It's always happened throughout history. There are just, you know, sometimes things just work and they make money and people go, even though they're not very good, and critics go, why are you seeing them? But overall, it does matter that you deliver. And it does matter who's cast. You can't just cast anybody. There's a junky Captain America that went straight to video. You know, so, you know, that they would have liked to release. I think it was Canon Films or who owned that movie. It was a junky little film. So, yeah, it matters very much that you pay the budget. You got to have the money on screen. You got to have talented actors. You know, Marvel's The Avengers isn't just a big blockbuster hit. It's also a very well-reviewed movie.
Let me ask you this. You asked me whether it was a good idea for Disney to buy Lucasfilm. I'm assuming that you feel the same way that it was.
It looks like it. I'm not sure of all the ins and outs of the deal. $4 billion is a lot of money, but given how Disney can leverage it, I think long term it's absolutely a no-brainer.
And so are you excited for some new Star Wars films?
Because George Lucas is not involved? Yes, I am. Otherwise, I'd be fearing them.
Okay. Well, I just mentioned Neil Gabler's piece, and he wrote that, I guess it was a one-off piece for the Los Angeles Times, which is, what is that again, Michael?
That's a newspaper.
And what are newspapers? Now, I'm kind of old enough to have been a paper boy, where I threw papers on people's driveway as a kid for money.
A newspaper is a website with information on it about the events of the day, and sometimes people print it out and staple it together for you and deliver it to your home.
Ah, okay, so it's all about the internet. Okay, just checking, because I was a little confused. I hadn't heard that word newspaper in so long. But I joke, of course. But we do have some news here about how newspapers, the circulation at newspapers, is actually growing, and it's thanks to digital.
That's right. Paywalls are sort of working. The New York Times has revenue issues. It's not that putting up a paywall has solved all their problems, but they did boost their circulation by 40% this year, thanks mostly to a huge increase in digital subscribers. The LA Times also grew last year by 11%. This is after years of declines for most newspapers. And smaller papers like the Tampa Bay Times are up 30% in subscriptions. The New York Star Ledger is up 48%. You know, these newspapers are seeing increases by 9%, 40%, 11% to any increase at all. Just simply stopping the decline is great news for them. People still want access to big newspapers. So we have a link on our website. We have a list of the top newspapers. Starts with the Wall Street Journal and the USA Today and the New York Times. And, you know, we combine the print, break it out, the print and digital. And you can see how they're all doing. USA Today is sort of in trouble.
Yeah, they're down nearly 4%.
They do not. Well, they're just in trouble economically. They've had a revamp of the newspaper's look. They're struggling apparently financially a little bit. They're down 4% in subscribers. They do not have a paywall on their website. And I can't imagine them doing one the way considering what USA Today is and the audience it reaches. It doesn't seem to make sense, but they're trying to struggle a bit for identity, and they do not have a paywall. Wall Street Journal has almost always had a paywall. The New York Times has a paywall. LA Times, they've gone up. New York Daily News, no paywall. They dropped 11%. San Jose Mercury News, New York Post, they're up a little bit, and they do have digital subscribers, but I don't know if they have a paywall.
Washington Post, yeah, you mentioned is down. Sorry, I'm covering old ground. Houston Chronicle down 12%.
Well, and the Washington Post has a paywall, so it's not a magic bullet. But, you know, people, obviously, if they can't access your website and they're interested in what you create, they're going to pay.
What's the deal with the Newark Star Ledger? Why is that up nearly 50%? Did the Bergen Record go bust or something? I mean, why are they so...
I think they made a big push into digital. I mean, they have 120... They have almost as many subscribers digitally as they do in print. That's very unusual.
Now, I wonder if those digital subscribers include the print subscribers or whether those are just digital.
No. These are separate.
Okay.
They're not counting ones where every print subscriber gets access to digital.
Well, and I would like to take this moment and this opportunity to ask the LA Times, which I subscribe to. I'm a paid subscriber. It winds up at the end of my driveway every morning. although I don't think a paper boy delivers it, I would like to ask them to fix their paywall, because I am constantly having to log in and it's constantly saying, I'm sorry, you know, your credentials are not, it's annoying. They have a paywall. I'm more than happy to pay for it, but their paywall is defective.
Well, that's a problem, because that's where people live. You probably don't pick up the print edition very much. Do you even get a print edition?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a print edition in years. I used to buy 3 or 4 papers a day, and I don't buy any papers anymore.
Now you just once print them all out while. And staple them together?
That's right. I buy USA Today on Wednesday for the Nielsen ratings,
because
I can't get those anywhere else, and I want that for my little charts. But that's pretty geeky, I know. But by and large, I go online and surf all over the place. So, you know, that's the world we live in these days. So you can see, look at the charts, see where your newspaper is. There's a lot of losers in the newspaper business. You know, these gains are really happening for the big name brand newspapers. The New York Times, which does have more digital subscribers than print subscribers. The Wall Street Journal, LA Times, all these big names, they are flourishing, or at least they have a chance of survival. Smaller newspapers that don't have a name brand audience, they're going to have trouble.
So basically what you're saying is branding works in movies with franchises like Star Wars and Lucasfilm. It also works in newspapers.
That's right, if you deliver quality.
And so when these newspapers put up the paywalls, it keeps people from reading some of their news, some of their articles and stories, but not all of them. You know, you get like a, you know, 10 to 15, 20, depending on the newspaper, free looks, free reads, however you want to call it, per month. But when it comes to major events, like, say, I don't know, off the top of my head, what would have been a major event in the past week or two?
Oh, the election.
The election, Hurricane Sandy. You know, then the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal say, hey, you know what? For the next 24 hours, we're going to take down the paywall. Everybody can read.
That's interesting. They recognize their role as a public servant, as a resource for the community. And so during Hurricane Sandy, for like, I think the whole weekend, basically, they let everybody come on as much as they wanted, because it was access to vital information. A not just a smart thing to do. It's probably part of their, you know, community obligation. So they did that. And then they did the same thing during the election, which I didn't quite expect. But they knew they were having tons of traffic and people wanted to come to their website. And they said, why not, you know, enjoy all those eyeballs for that one day? So for 24 hours, I think roughly from, you know, 6 p.m. on election day through the next day, they just had the door wide open, sort of an open house. Hey, you're liking what you see at the New York Times? You enjoy Nate Silver's column? Why not come back and buy a digital subscription? I think it was a smart thing to do. Good for business.
Right. Now, you know what else is good for business?
What?
Getting more subscribers.
And that's true.
And that's exactly what Spotify has done. They are about to raise a $100 million round of funding at a valuation that's, you know, originally was rumored to be $4 billion. It turns out it's going to be $3.25 billion. That's a lot. You know, that's
what Spotify is worth.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Now, they're not a publicly traded company, right?
No, they're private. They have 15 million active users, 4 million of whom are paying users, and at least 1 million of those paying users are here in the United States.
So a lot of people in the U.S. use it for free with limited access.
And
a million people in the U.S. pay to have regular full access to Spotify.
That's right.
Which is kind of like having a monthly subscription to satellite radio or cable TV. You know, they're doing it for Spotify. It's one more bill, but they think it's worth it.
That's right. And I guess, you know, they've already raised $100 million. They did that back in June of 2011. So This would be their second, well, probably more than their second round, but their second big round of funding, that's for sure.
And they expect to gross around $900 million this year?
Well, they were on, that was their estimate. In 2011, they showed a loss of nearly, what, like $60 million on revenues of $244 million. And I guess this year they made $200 million in total revenue over the first 6 months of 2012. And they're on an annual run rate to make about $500 million in revenue, that's not profit, by January.
Okay. Oh, so where is that? What is that $900 million figure?
That was their estimates.
Oh, and now they're wrong. They were off by $400 million?
Those weren't necessarily true figures. Those were estimates that were rumored to have been estimated inside Spotify.
I don't even know what you're trying to say. Did they claim to some people that they would have $900 million in revenue and end up with $500 million?
Some people claimed, Spotify told me that they were going to make $900 million.
And they're still losing money.
They're still losing money, yes. That's the B.
So would you give them money? Would you invest in Spotify?
I do every month.
No, you buy their services, but would you invest in Spotify? Do you think they're doing a good enough job that you would feel safe putting an investment in that company?
No. I mean, let's put it this way. I don't, because I don't have money to burn, but I could see why people would. In other words, if I lost the money that I invested in Spotify, it would hurt. There are folks.
No, you're an investor. Forget your personal thing. Is it a smart investment?
If I'm Goldman Sachs, yes, it is. Because they are by far the market leader and they have the name brand recognition and they do a wonderful job of marketing themselves. Part of their problem.
You're not worried about Apple stepping in with their own service? You're not worried that they're the market leader and yet they still don't make money? And how many years are you going to wait for them to make money?
Well, no, because they're not in every territory. They're kind of expanding into Eastern Europe. They just expanded into Ireland. They're going to be expanding into Latin America. So they're not in every market and they're doing this well. The problem, of course, is that they have all of these, you know, deals with labels that require that they pay $200 million annually or 75% of their total revenue, whichever is higher. And they're about to hit that 75% mark.
Which means?
That if they make, let's say they make $1 billion, 75% of that profit will go to, 75% of that revenue, $750 million will go to their label, go to the labels under their deals.
It's not because they made $1 billion. They have a percentage goes to the labels, right? It's not, I mean, you've got the cart before the horse. They could make more revenue, as we said before, if they had more ads or did this and that, and the mix would be different. They're just paying out a lot to artists to use their songs.
That's right.
But it's not a fixed part of their revenue. It's just that they refuse to run ads and do other things to increase revenue.
Well, they do run ads, actually.
Not more ads.
Well,
isn't that the whole point of what you talked about 2 weeks ago?
That was Pandora, not Spotify.
It's the same idea, isn't it?
No, not at all. No, this is basically their deals are you pay the labels $200 million annually, unless 75% of your revenue is more than $200 million.
Oh, God, you're just making my head hurt. What the hell are you trying to say?
Basically, they're going to have to pay.
They do not have a fixed number. Do the labels get a fixed cut of their revenue no matter what it is? It's not a royalty rate. It's an actual, the labels have a piece of their company where they get a set percentage of their revenue?
75% if...
No, that's no. I'm saying, is that the deal? That it's always a set percentage of their revenue once certain levels are reached?
Yes,
no matter 75%. What you make, we get 3/4 of your money.
No, that's not... you have to make more than $200 million.
Right, so if you hit a certain level, we get 75% of whatever you make, period. It's not you could have other revenue streams to do other stuff. No matter what we get, no matter how you make it, we get 75% of that money.
Correct.
So why would you invest in them where 3/4 of their revenue goes to somebody else? Why wouldn't you invest in a label? Why would you invest in them if the majority of their profits go to somebody else?
Well, 25%, depending on what their expenses are, 25% could be a lot of money.
I think it's crazy.
Well, so then my investing in them, which has not happened, would be a big deal then if you heard about it?
It would be a big whoop because you're not going to get your money back.
Certainly, I'm not going to raise the money to invest in the first place.
All right. Does that mean it's time for Karen?
Well, yes, Michael, it is indeed time to bring up Karen here. And, you know, that means, as I mentioned earlier, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. And joining us this week to discuss them is Karen Woodward, who was our former host.
Yay!
The ray of sunshine.
Now, Karen, you ran off to become a multimillionaire or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, that's what I ran off to.
Or something social. You had a lot of friends or something like that. I can't remember.
I ran off because my whole life was starting to be taken over by my social media marketing business. And I didn't have time to have fun anymore, guys.
Oh,
well, thank
God you made time for us today.
I know.
And some of your clients, of course, are in the entertainment industry. So if you have to abstain from any of these stories, please let us know. Or recuse yourself, I guess would be the right word. But our first story today is about Mark Wahlberg. And what we want to know is really which came first, the internet rumor or the truth? And we may never know. But director Michael Bay went online and dissed earlier internet rumors that the Transformers franchise was ready for a reboot and needed a new male star, and that Mark Wahlberg might be a perfect fit. Of course, Bay had just worked with Wahlberg on his first non-Transformer movie in years, a movie called Pain and Gain, due out next April. So it all made sense, really. Bay said, of course, "Phooey," and that's a direct quote, there's nothing to it. Then he said it again, but then he posted a comment online on Halloween saying, quote, "I had such a great time working with Mark on Pain and Gain, and he gave such a great performance. Well, let's say that very internet chatter gave me some ideas. We are at the inception of our story process right now on T4. Let's say some ideas are gaining traction with me and my writer. So I'm here to say, thanks, internet chatter, end quote. And now it's official, Mark Wahlberg will star in the next Transformers movie, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You guys already know what I'm going to say to this.
But we're looking forward to hearing it.
Big whoop. Man gets job.
But Shia LaBeouf loses job.
Well, that's just awesome.
Oh, my God. Well, I think Shia LaBeouf kind of lost that job for himself. He did not want to do it anymore.
He'd done it three times. They wanted to reboot it. It's natural now. That's what people do. My thought would always be, hey, it's a billion-dollar franchise. I'd want Shia LaBeouf to do two or three more until they started to fade as a businessman. But as a person, you know, hey, all the three movies sucked, so maybe Mark Wahlberg will bring something new to it. So it's a big whoop, of course, man. Gets job, but good for Mark Wahlberg. I'm always happy to see him get good work.
I'm tempted to kind of sing a little like...
No,
you know,
no.
Okay, well... All right, if you insist, I will not sing the Elmo theme song here. But Kevin Clash, the voice of Elmo and an executive producer on Sesame Street, is taking a leave of absence to, quote unquote, protect his reputation. And that's after allegations surfaced that he had sex with a minor. The man made the charge in June. He was 23 in June, but says the molestation occurred when he was 16 years old. Clash admitted having sexual relations with the man, but says they were consenting adults when it occurred. He told TMZ, the bastion of truthiness in entertainment journalism.
Hey, don't mock TMZ. I mean, admit it. They're right. I would say 95% of the time.
Well, that's actually true. But, and this is a quote. He says, I am deeply saddened that he is trying to make it into something it was not, end quote. The age of consent in New York State is 17, though it's unclear where they were when these events took place. I think I know where they were. They were on Sesame Street. Actually, Sesame Workshop said they took these allegations very seriously. They met with the man twice and communicated with him repeatedly. And then they launched a full investigation and decided that the charges were, quote unquote, unsubstantiated, but that Clash had shown poor judgment and violated company policy about internet usage. And so they took the appropriate action. The organization said, and this is a quote from, I guess, Sesame Workshop, Elmo is bigger than any one person and will continue to be an integral part of Sesame Street. Now, I take umbrage with that because I think Elmo is probably one of the shortest guys around there, in my opinion. And if you look at Big Bird, who's been in the news a lot lately, you know, he's probably the tallest one. In any case, Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a very big deal. I mean, obviously, Sesame Street values their public image, their family-friendly entertainment. They reach out to people. It sounds like the best-case scenario is that Kevin Clash had sex with a 17-year-old. Well, that isn't very good for business. So I don't know what's going to happen to him. Elmo's a huge franchise and has been for years. From the way this came out, I feel like they did not contact the police. And in that case, I think they made the big mistake that everybody makes. They put their institution and protecting their people ahead of just getting the facts out and getting the bad news over with. Back in June, they should have not launched a full investigation to decide whether this guy's allegations had any substantiation. They should have just said, call the cops, pick up the phone and call the police. It doesn't matter what it is. You don't want it to get out, of course, because even if you like the guy and you think there's nothing to it and he says it's not true, doesn't matter. You don't investigate crimes. You don't send Big Bird out there with a magnifying glass to look for clues. You're not in the business of doing that. Somebody calls up and makes some wild accusation. You hope there's no truth to it, but you pick up the phone and you call the police. That's what they should have done. I don't think that's what they did here. And I think that was a mistake.
Yeah, I agree. This is a big deal. But I think, am I the only person who thinks that it's highly suspect that this kid comes forward, this man at this point comes forward like 6 or 7 years after?
No,
it happened?
Not at all. That's how
right
it happens.
About the time when a documentary is coming out about Kevin Clash, that's not a coincidence. This guy
That documentary came out last year.
Yeah, it did.
And people who are molested, if that's what's alleged here, they often take many years to come forward. That's what we've seen with the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts and time and time again. Look at the people at the BBC. The BBC's dealing with the same thing. People take years to come forward. They often never come forward when they're raped or molested. Young people don't feel they have they feel it's their fault. They feel ashamed. They feel belittled. Then when they come forward, people don't want to believe them. Who wants to accuse a famous person? There's very often a huge gap between when an event occurs, a molestation, and that person having the courage to come forward and tell somebody, anybody. So that's very common. And that's why the laws of, you know, about different states have been changed to reflect the fact that people take years to come forward. You can't let the statute of limitations pass. And in fact, I think New York State, again, is considering suspending the statute of limitations for molestation to try and allow some more people to come forward about being molested by members of the Catholic Church. So this is that's very, very common that people would take years to come forward. And his book came out years ago, Kevin Clash's biography. The documentary film came out last year or the year before. So this is not pegged to some media release. Why did he call them and not the cops? I don't know. I don't know what the deal is. God willing, there's no truth to
money.
It.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Well, but that doesn't change the fact that something wrong may have occurred. And it doesn't change the fact that even if it was legal, having the voice of Elmo have sex with a 16-year-old, which would be the legal age of consent in Georgia, or 17 years old in the case of New York, would not be good for business and would look bad. And they wanted to, you know, not let it get out. And they said it's not their job to decide whether there's truth to it. Not their job. You know, someone calls up and tries to blackmail you because they accuse an employee of rape, pick up the phone and call the police. Yes, you call your lawyer in first, you talk to them, you tell your guy, hey, you need to get a lawyer, but you pick up the phone and you call the police. They didn't seem to do that. And whether it's blackmail or they thought the guy was unhinged or whether there's truth to it, you know, who knows? Not for them to decide.
Could they have hired Big Bird as like a private eye?
Exactly. You'll see that on The Daily Show tonight or tomorrow night. Daily Show will make fun of this by showing Big Bird, you know, following steps and trying to track down clues. So maybe it's just a bad situation all around.
Crack down on Sesame Street.
Do you think people would care if it was a girl?
Yes, I think they would.
I would feel the same way that I do now.
Yeah, I imagine it's slightly worse that it's a young man. But even if he had sex with a 16-year-old girl, even if she was the age of consent for wherever they were, I think that would be a PR disaster.
True. And we'd all be wondering.
PR disaster now.
Yeah. Well, this next story is about somebody who hasn't been in the news for more than, you know, I think the last time we talked about him was 30 seconds ago. I mean, you know, it turns out that facts matter. And apparently facts can be very profitable. Nate Silver is who I'm talking about, and he is the statistician who made his bones in baseball and then moved on to politics with his 538 blog. And if you live in the U.S. and you haven't heard of Nate Silver and the 538 blog, you are living under a rock. His methods and even his personal appearances were attacked by the right for the past year, especially as the election drew closer, and Silver's analysis demonstrated in numerous ways that the election wasn't a toss-up at all. Wasn't as close as everybody reported.
No, it was close. It just wasn't a toss-up.
Oh, okay. While others confused quote-unquote close with quote-unquote a toss-up, Silver showed in numerous ways how Obama had a small but persistent lead, especially in the swing states. Ultimately, he called all 50 states correctly and nailed all but two Senate races, taking a victory lap in the media and watching his new book, The Signal and the Noise, leap up the Amazon sales charts all the way to number two in the days, of course, right after the election. The number one book is actually about Nate Silver. It's a diary of a wimpy kid. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
You know, I think it's cool, but and it's great for him. It's a big deal for him, but I think ultimately it's big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big deal, perhaps in the sense that how anybody can be catapulted onto the charts, and it's so much easier for people to buy books now and get a Kindle copy. That just like on the music charts in the UK, you used to see if a song was used in a commercial, it would jump onto the charts right away because they reflected actual sales. Now that happens more in the US. And I think the book charts are the same way. Now we know actual sales figures, but now because it's so easy to buy a book, you see them on TV, you turn around, you buy the book, you got it in your hand 2 minutes later. And I think you're seeing a lot more volatility and a lot more things leaping up the charts quickly. And I think that's a positive sign as how people can act on their impulses and pursue some, you know, a serious work of nonfiction like his book. And get it quickly. I think that impression, go on a show, you get a hit, your song jumps up the chart, your book jumps up the chart. I think that's a good thing. So I think it's a big deal long term that the charts reflect the actual tastes and books that people are buying right now.
Well, I know this next story, Karen, you're going to love it because CBS has resisted the siren call of Hulu and Netflix, two of your favorite websites, I know.
they really are.
Well, they have resisted all of those streaming sites for a long time. But CBS has finally decided that making more money off of their TV library is actually, it's better, and this is scientifically, Nate Silver told them this, it's better than making less money. And yes, CBS has decided to join the 21st century. The network signed a multi-year, non-exclusive deal with Hulu to make some 2,600 episodes of shows like Numbers and Medium, CSI Miami, Star Trek, and the current hit I Love Lucy and The Twilight Zone, available on Hulu Plus starting in January. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's long overdue. I love that it's non-exclusive, because I think that's the way to go. Let the people decide which service they want to use. You know, you shouldn't limit yourself just to Hulu. That's not a smart thing to do at this stage. You look at the number of episodes, 2,600. That sounds like so many. But just the six shows they named, those are 900 episodes right there. So you could have like 18 shows and you'd reach that 2,600 episode limit. So it's not that many TV shows and not that many episodes when you think about how many shows a hit series like I Love Lucy can produce, which is 181, or CSI Miami. I mean, it's 232 episodes they created for that. So it sounds like a ton of episodes. It's probably not. It's probably about 20, 25 shows, but it's an important step.
Now, Karen, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I agree that it's an important step for CBS, but I do think that ultimately it's just a big whoop. Where are the recent episodes of their hit shows?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I think if they see this work with Hulu Plus and they get money, that hopefully they'll cave and realize that they should be on there and other sites as well.
But yeah, but they're probably not making any money in advertising on any of these shows, like Numbers and, well, Medium maybe is in syndication, but, well, they might all be in syndication, but they're probably not making a ton of money in advertising on them, whereas they are on their current hit shows right now. So it's really no
step.
Skin off their back to have given Hulu, you know, Numbers. I mean, we.
Right. It's just about 20, 25 shows. So it's not a huge chunk of their library, which just shows you how many TV shows and episodes television creates and what a massive library they have to exploit online. Do you watch Elementary, by the way? That's one of their new hit shows.
You know, I do, but it's on at the same time as Nashville, and it's not available on Hulu Plus. And so the only way to watch it is online. And I don't really like to watch TV on my computer. I prefer to watch it on my iPad, so I don't watch it all that often.
I'm going to introduce you to this new technology, fairly new, DVRs, digital video.
No,
record.
I know, but I have TiVo, so that means that I can't watch something and tape something else at the same time.
You can if you have a
really.
You can if you have a TiVo Series 3. So I'm going to introduce.
So I don't. My TiVo is so embarrassingly old, but I don't want to touch it because I have my whole thing all set up. Like, I don't want to ruin it. You know what's even more embarrassing, you guys? I have one of those old fashioned TVs. It's like a big old box.
So do I, actually. Yes.
Are you sure you're not listening to I Love Lucy on the radio? You know, like maybe.
I know. I'm like living in black and white here. My brother came to visit and he looked at it. He's like, what the hell is that?
Your children will be like, why is the TV sick? It looks all bloated.
That's totally it. Why is the TV fat?
Well, I mentioned Elementary because that's going to be airing after the Super Bowl. I think it's a pretty fun show. I don't watch it every week, but I like the cast. And that's going to be their big show that they promote after the Super Bowl in January. So that's going to get that prime slot. And so 34 million people are going to have a chance to sample it. And that'll hopefully keep the show doing well. It's already had a full season renewal, as has Nashville, which also has a full season renewal. But Nashville isn't opposite Elementary. Nashville is opposite Chicago Fire. That's on Wednesday. Elementary is on Thursday.
Thursday at what time?
10 o'clock.
I don't know what I'm watching, but I'm clearly watching something else.
Maybe I'm wrong. I believe it's Thursday at 10. Thursdays, I'm going to pull out my USA Today chart.
Oh, my gosh. The sound hear
wait, wait,
is...
I've got an old Entertainment Weekly chart. Hang on.
It's opposite Rock Center and Scandal on ABC.
Okay, I am not watching either one of those shows.
So Elementary, Thursday at 10. It's a Johnny Lee Miller, Lucy Liu. It's a procedural. It's nothing great, but I like them, and I'm a Sherlock Holmes nut, so I keep dipping into it. Nashville has been renewed.
This on my season pass.
Yeah.
Well, and now, of course, you'll have to watch a whole darn football game before watching this episode in February.
That's right.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's February, not January?
January, whenever it is.
Oh, okay.
Well, let's move on to the next story. Melville House is an acclaimed independent publisher, and one of their iconic lines is called The Art of the Novella, a selection of classic and current novellas by major writers. Melville is now taking a stab at not one, but two trends in publishing. Going out of business and no, just kidding. One one is the subscription model and the other is to combine print and digital. The publisher is offering 3-month, 6-month, and of course 1-year subscriptions to its line of titles under the Art of the Novella umbrella. Now say that 6 times fast.
I know, right?
The Art of the Novella umbrella.
Right, exactly. The longer the subscription, of course, the cheaper the price. You get 2 novellas a month and can choose print, digital, or both. Subscribe for 1 year and you get two releases a month costing $7 for digital, $13 for print, or $17 for both. Plus, get this. Now, this is the kicker. A t-shirt. It turns out...
Tote bag. Is there a tote bag involved?
I think that's only at Barnes & Noble. It turns out their backlist, this is Melville House's backlist, they're turning it into an active part of the company rather than just, you know, hoping people discover all their past titles. And it really leverages digital to make the subscription more enticing. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
You know, you probably should have asked Michael to answer this first because I think he'll understand it better than I do. This is essentially just a digital book club, no?
Yes, in a way, yes. And they're using their backlist to do it. But they're also offering print and digital, which most publishers don't yet. They don't give you the digital, you know, with the print. I've been arguing that digital should be free. If you buy a print copy, they should give you the digital for free. And you find that in small houses that deal with like tech manuals and things like that. But it's more and more you're starting to see regular publishers of literary fiction do that as well. And the subscription model is also interesting. I think it's a big deal because it is two big trends that publishing is just dipping their toes into. Subscription models where maybe you can have full access to a library like Netflix. Sperling's been talking about that. A Netflix for books, he thinks. What a great idea that'd be. You pay a monthly fee and you get to access all the books you want.
That's
Imagine
right.
how that would work out well.
I would and love that.
Well, it's kind of like my gym membership. I go, oh my gosh, I could read all the books I want and then never read a single one.
Right. But it would be, I think that's, you know, a very strong possibility for a revenue stream down the road. I'm sure major publishers will do that at some point. And I think combining print with digital, there's no reason to make people choose. Do you want to read this on your Kindle or do you want to read this, you know, in your home in a physical copy? If you want to pay less and just get the Kindle or the digital version, okay. But if you buy a print copy, they should throw in the digital and the audiobook version as well. That way you can read the book as many ways as possible. Just like when you buy a movie on home video now, you usually get a Blu-ray, a DVD, and a digital download. So you can watch it in your car, on your Blu-ray, and you can watch it on your iPad, whatever you want. You don't have to decide. The same should be true for books. So I think because it combines these two big trends that are coming up down the road, I think it's sort of a big deal.
Well, you know, I thought a bigger deal was Kindle's reading library.
Yes, I agree.
That is, to me, a much bigger deal. They don't have a whole bunch of, you know, really great stuff. A lot of it is just stuff that's in the public domain. But I like the idea, and I thought that they are heading in the right direction. That, to me, which at this point, Sperling is what, maybe a year old?
Yeah, probably.
If you own a Kindle and you own a Prime subscription to Amazon, right. The Amazon yeah. Prime subscription, is that what you have to have?
Right. Yes.
I think so,
If you own that, you get to rent or borrow out for free one book at a time or one book a month, which is it? Right.
One book a month.
Yeah.
One book a month, which is nice. You know how they do that? They pay for the book. If you rent a book and it's not a public domain book, they pay the publisher as if they just bought a new copy of that book.
That's right.
They pay the full price.
I think is a big deal.
Well, that's not a workable business model. That's them trying to, you know, Bigfoot
well,
other people.
That's
and
actually
keep them...
why I think it's a big deal.
Well, you know right. what they're
it's,
trying to do is they're trying to get
a short-term fix.
What they're trying to do is get people to sign up for Prime, because once you're a member of Prime, you start going, you know what? I could just buy that on Amazon. And you start buying.
That's exactly what I do.
Right, exactly.
Right, but remember what Lost Leaders did to the record industry, the music industry, to all the record stores around the country, what they're doing to bookstores around the country. It's a short-term game, but in the long term, you're going to find yourself stuck with Amazon and nobody else.
Well, speaking of Amazon, a mini scandal erupted when people started writing stories about review factories, and these are businesses that would generate positive reviews of your book, if you have one, for a small fee. So Amazon decided to take action. Step number one. Remove any reviews by authors. So if you're an author with an Amazon Central website, and those websites are an area of their site promoting your work as an author, they've apparently gone in and deleted all your reviews. Although, if you've written a review and you're not an author, then the fact that you've written a review makes you an author. Anyway, sure, authors blurb for other authors all the time, and these reviews had the author's name on them, but Amazon decided it was all suspect. Maybe you're helping out a friend, or maybe even worse, you're bad-mouthing a book by someone else to keep your book ranked higher. Whatever the case, they just decided the easiest thing to do was remove any and all comments and reviews by authors. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
This is a big deal, and it's too bad that it got to this, because I think it's... I'm sure that a lot of authors are actually writing reviews in good faith, and it just sucks that there are companies out there that will write a good review for a fee. It's disgusting.
Well, what I don't get is that that doesn't solve the problem. The authors Well, right, because the people who are doing it for a fee are anonymous nobody. So this doesn't deal with them. All it does is stop authors who identify themselves, who have a website. You can see what they've written and that they're an author and that they have books out. So you can take with a grain of salt what they say and say, hey, this guy's a mystery writer. I bet he only gave this mystery a bad review because, you know, he wants his books to do well. Or you can say, oh, it may be his friend or something. But they're identifying who they are. They're public and above board about it. So what's the problem?
No, you're absolutely right. But you also touched on something else that is equally important, and that is that people can usually tell whether somebody's just, you know, writing something for their own benefit.
We call those plants or shills here at Showbiz Sandbox.
Okay, yeah. Well, then you can usually tell.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I don't think you can tell article by article, especially if they're through these factories where they pay them. But I think what you know is that you just say, gee, if there's only a few reviews, I can't trust them. I want to see a book with hundreds of reviews. Then I can imagine and assume that most of those are real. You know, if you've got hundreds of reviews, you know that people have actually reviewed it. You've got three or four, they could all be suspect or a friend of the author.
All three of them are suspect.
Well, now, you know, we just talked about how Amazon is doing this renting the book that is really being paid for. But, you know, and of course, there's this big antitrust lawsuit going on here in the U.S. with Apple and some publishers. Well, that same antitrust case, well, not the same case, but that same theory, there was a case in the EU. And I guess over the weekend or late last week, the European Union. I can't say
the EU.
Thank you. These regulators, they ended their antitrust probe because Apple and the four publishers, they settled, basically.
And Amazon won a victory in the European Union.
Thank you. Wow, that was so much easier. You should do that.
Yes, they won a victory in the EU. They're going to get to keep pricing books the way they want, which means that if a publisher sells them a book, they can sell it at a loss and, you know, have a chance of driving other people out of business to do whatever they want. If they want to sell it at a loss, that's their right. And they won that right in the EU, even though other publishers and book retailers said this is bad for the European Union. It's bad for the industry as a whole. They shouldn't be allowed to do it. They're going to be driving people out of business, and then they'll be the only people selling books. But
wait,
they won a victory.
Why would it be bad for the EU?
Well, it's bad in America. Is it good if every other bookstore in the country shuts down and the only place you can buy books is Amazon? That's, you know, might not be a great use of our public resource of, you know, the book publishing industry.
Yeah,
you know,
but the mom and pop shops are all going away anyway.
Well, because of Amazon. Because they're selling books that you're getting a book for free each month. They pay the publisher an entire, you know, can you imagine if you went to the library and the library had to pay $20 every month just for you to borrow that book and read it? That's, you know, that's a destructive practice that lets you get used to an unreasonable expectation, drives other people out of business. And yeah, all those mom and pop bookstores go out of business and they're gone forever and you can never get them back. There are no
any bookstores going out of business. I don't even know where there is a bookstore around here.
Yeah, so it's a big problem, but they won their legal fight in Europe over this particular issue. Amazon will continue to be able to price books the way they want.
And I'd like to thank CJ Flynn, a former guest here on the show and a listener, for sending in that story. The next story here, Karen, is really one we thought you'd be interested in. For the first time in its history, NBC's morning news show Today will have a woman in charge. News stories say Alexandra Wallace of NBC News will take the reins of the four-hour franchise, which has been battling and losing to ABC's Good Morning America after a 16 years at number one, dominating the morning ratings. This will mark the first time a woman has been in charge of Today, even though the wildly profitable show is geared towards attracting women. Good Morning America has had a woman in charge on two occasions, but it's the first time for NBC. Today has been battered ever since Ann Curry was forced out to make room for Savannah Guthrie in June after just 1 year on the job, and she was the co-host there. Wallace has yet to be officially announced among her current duties right now, overseeing Ann Curry's work for NBC's Rock Center with Brian Williams. I think NBC really wants Ann Curry to succeed. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I defer to Karen.
I know you guys want me to say that this is a big deal, but I have to say, I think this is a big whoop. I think this is woman gets job. And the very fact that I feel that way, I think is the big deal. Maybe a bigger deal is the fact that there aren't any women who are in a position to be qualified for this job. That's a big deal on a different level. But the fact
look, they
that
are qualified,
particular...
they just haven't gotten it yet. Now they have it. You're saying Andrea Wallace isn't qualified?
No, no, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that the fact that we're making this a big deal is probably more troubling than anything else. I wish that it was that we weren't still finding this to be a big deal.
Well, I don't think it'll be headlines around the country. I don't think it'll be put down as a marker of women's
rights. It was,
right
though. This was a headline yesterday.
Well, I thought it was a small headline in the media section. But I think it's long overdue. I think it's a little bizarre. You know, when you think about the areas where women don't succeed, you know, there's no female head of a defense contractor or whatever, no female head of the NFL, which is stupid. I'm sure Condoleezza Rice would love to be the titular head of the NFL. But the Today Show and Good Morning America, it's kind of bizarre it took so long. So I think you're right in a sense. It's not a big deal. It was long overdue. But boy, you know, if you're trying to reach women, it might make sense to have one of them in charge.
Well, let's move on to talk about another woman, or at least a young lady, Taylor Swift. She's been in the news a lot lately because she set all sorts of records when her new album Red was released. It became the first album in more than a decade to sell more than 1 million copies in a single week. The last act to do that was Eminem in 2002. The album is only the 18th album in SoundScan history, which dates all the way back to 1991, to sell more than 1 million copies. That is remarkable to me. She sold 1.2 million copies and Britney Spears sold, I guess, 1.3 million copies of, I can't believe I'm about to say this, Oops, I Did It Again. Taylor is the first woman to have two albums sell more than 1 million copies in a week. And given all her TV appearances where she performed and did gymnastics, and I mean, she was everywhere, it seems she's been taking some singing lessons too, which, according to Karen, is money well spent. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
You know, good for her, but ultimately I think it's sort of a big whoop, although I could be convinced otherwise.
Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal in the sense for the music industry that you can still move
exactly.
A lot of copies. So, I mean, that's very important. It's still number one in its second week, so that's a good sign for her. You know, we've seen other artists who've been big multi-platinum artists like Carrie Underwood struggle to go gold. I mean, people are just not buying albums right now. So it can still work. It can still happen. I think that's important. She has a number 5 hit single, We're Never Ever Getting Back Together.
Ever.
But
I hate you,
you
bastard.
I went to Billboard to check out and see what was going on this week and see if, you know, she was still number one and all that.
She
is. The top story on Billboard, when you come to the homepage, is who should be Justin Bieber's new girlfriend? If you want to talk about a website and a business that is out of their minds and has no idea of what they should be doing in the new digital world, just go to billboard.com for idiots who are desperately trying to reach an audience that they should never be reaching for, competing with, I don't know, teen people, you know, photos of the week, Justin Bieber's new girlfriend. Give me a break. You know, talk about destroying a brand. Watch it happen in real time at billboard.com.
The views of Michael Giltz are not necessarily those of Showbiz Sandbox or its affiliates. In any case, maybe we should move on to some other. Well,
seriously, Justin Bieber's girlfriend. Don't you think that's embarrassing?
Well,
for Billboard.
Yeah, well, yes, but
yes.
I'm trying to move us along.
They're trying to make themselves relevant.
No, they're trying to make themselves something they shouldn't, which is a gossipy teen website with lots
of
photos.
That's probably what is selling advertisements these days.
But that's not going to work for Billboard. They're never going to succeed reaching teenagers. No teen is ever going to say, I wonder what Billboard says about Justin Bieber's new girlfriend. It's just not going to happen. You got to play to your strength. You can't try to be something you're not. It won't work. It's a bad idea.
Okay, then. Moving along.
No, I don't disagree.
Yeah, I know.
Moving along to Downton Abbey, the UK soap opera. Downton Abbey, of course, is the name of it. It doesn't begin airing here. It's third season in the US until January. Except for those of us who have downloaded it, which I'm not saying I have. But it's already proven itself in the UK. This is Downton Abbey. Where, you know, this is where season 3 ranks as the most popular yet for the series, averaging 9.7 million viewers, including same-day viewing on repeats and DVR. Season 1 averaged 8.4 million viewers, and season 2 was at 9.5 million. This is one of the first times we've had DVR figures for a UK show, so that's kind of important. Downton Abbey won Sunday night in the ratings for its finale with an average of 10.1 million viewers. However, The X Factor had a higher peak viewing, and Strictly Come Dancing, the name of that show is horrible, may well have a higher average for the season. Downton still has a two-hour special to air on Christmas, the most competitive day of the year for TV. Michael, big deal or big whoop? Or can we just move on to the next?
Karen, do you watch the show?
I do. I love it.
I didn't like the second season at all. I thought it was a disaster creatively. And everybody kept saying, yeah, I didn't like it either. I wasn't happy with this. I didn't like that. But, you know, the Christmas special was good. And I didn't even finish watching the season. I finally finished and I finally watched the Christmas special. It was like a whole new show. It was like back to – it was unbelievable. It was a complete return to what made the show potentially fun. And I'm like, oh, my God, I actually have hope for season three now. So, you know, it's a big whoop. It's maintaining its success in the UK. Of course, why wouldn't it? But I'm glad to see that last year's Christmas special from a year ago was actually good. So God knows, maybe it'll be good again.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the fact that the numbers are up gives me hope. I'm so excited because I actually had the opportunity, like most people, to download it and watch it. But I wanted to watch it in January when all of my friends are watching it too, because that's fun.
Well, exactly. And just to set the record straight, I did not download it. I haven't watched
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're already knocking on your door. At your door right now.
Well, maybe the FBI is here for my emails.
Okay, David Petraeus.
Are you a groupie for military leaders?
No, I'm just kidding. William Faulkner, moving along to past authors here. William Faulkner is suing Woody Allen, and I'm assuming it's not William Faulkner, since if it was, it would be the ghost of William Faulkner. But that's in any case. You know, if that sounds like a plot, yeah. If it sounds like a plot twist out of one of Woody Allen's hit films about time travel, you're kind of getting warm. The Faulkner estate is suing Allen and Sony over the movie Midnight in Paris. In that film, and so we know, by the way, if he's only suing now, he only watched it on DVD.
Just you know. You're probably right.
In that film, Owen Wilson's character paraphrased Faulkner's famous dictum when he said, "The past is not dead. Actually, it's not even past." The studio says it's fair use. The estate says the fame of the quote makes the fact that it's one line and a longer piece immaterial. A longer piece? How about 120 minutes longer? They know they were, you know, the filmmaker knew that he was quoting and benefiting from the work of Faulkner and should have asked for permission, just as they say Ron Howard asked for permission to use a Faulkner quote in a TV show he produced, paying a fee in the process. So, Michael, is this a big deal, or as some people would say, a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because it just illustrates copyright law and how messed up it is. You know, right now, copyright is life plus 70 years. So Faulkner died in 1962. So this book that the quote is pulled from will not enter the public domain until 2032, which is absurd. It's the Mickey Mouse law. They keep extending the life of copyright because they don't want Mickey Mouse to go into the public domain. That's what Disney fights for. Even if it would go back to the 70s when copyright was life plus 50 years, that means this quote would have gone into the public domain this year, like in June or July of 2012. So it still wouldn't have been in the public domain when the movie came out last year. And it's like you say, it's a paraphrase of a single quote. And in fact, the full quote is, "The past is not dead. Actually, it's not even past." You know who said that? Faulkner. And I met him, too. I met him at a dinner party. I mean, that's Owen Wilson's quote from the movie.
I mean, he attributed it, right?
Right.
I
he's even giving an attribution to Faulkner to might drive people to the book to read it. So, I mean, it's absurd.
This is going to be thrown out. Sorry, Karen. Go ahead.
I know. I do think it's, to me, the big deal here is copyright law in general, because I agree. And then you have to start considering fair use, which I do think this probably comes under, but fair use from compared to movies, it's compared to a written work. So I'll bet that if you just looked at it as a screenplay, it probably is fair use, because fair use, it's like use a certain percentage or whatever. I should have looked it up, but there's it's a small amount and it's attributed. I think if you're going to look at it from the screenplay perspective, this is fair use. But I don't know what the rules are in terms of like a movie.
We need a lawyer. And yet we would think differently if it was a song, wouldn't we? If it was a Beatles song, we wouldn't be surprised that they went and got permission and paid money, even if it was just 30 seconds or 20 seconds of a song. We'd probably
I would feel the same way. I mean, if it was part of the chorus, maybe not. But if it was just a line in a song that quoted this and said Faulkner said that?
No, I mean, they played the song. I mean, they played the actual Beatles recording.
Oh, again, I think that, you can do, 20 seconds worth or something. There's a certain amount of time that you were allowed to use and is considered fair use.
And I'd like to remind Lucasfilm that about that, because we did play 20 seconds of Star Wars music at the head of the show.
Right. And in our links, you'll find a link to the story, also to William Faulkner's entry on Wikipedia, and a link to the book that it comes from, Requiem for a Nun. And another person who paraphrased that quote and probably didn't pay for it, Barack Obama, who quoted that famous quote in his speech on race that he did during the 2008 campaign. It's one of the best speeches he's ever written. Certainly a great, great speech. So if you want to check it out, you'll find that quote is in there as well.
Well, now, somebody who's not paraphrasing things is Louis C.K. He's actually quoting himself because he's a stand-up comic, and he is headed back to HBO. And after going the indie route with his last comedy special by recording it himself and releasing the special online directly to fans, Louis C.K. is going old school and doing a special for HBO. It will air in 2013 on the pay cable channel, a mainstay for comics since its launch in the 1970s. But Louis C.K. isn't completely abandoning his digital ways. He says the special will be available a few months after it airs on HBO at $5 per download, and that'll be available on his website. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
It's probably a big whoop, but only because the bigger deal was when Louis C.K. originally sold his stand-up act on the website for $5. And now that it's getting HBO involved, it's just kind of disappointing. But I don't consider this to be that big a deal.
I kind of agree. It's kind of like, oh, so you kind of were this trendsetter with the whole internet thing, and you talked about how great it was and how you made more money doing it that way by releasing it yourself for $5 to fans than you would have if you did the HBO or Comedy Central special. But now you're going back to HBO. At the same time, I could see Louis C.K. saying, hey, I just want to write jokes and tell my jokes. I don't want to be a producer and have to deal with all this, you know, technical mumbo jumbo. And it was a lot of work to pull that off. Michael.
I think it's a big deal because it proves the value of old media. He got HBO to change their rules. I imagine most of the time HBO holds on to their shows and has the right to use them on HBO to go and sells them on DVD. And they probably didn't like the idea of Louis C.K. selling it for $5 on his website, but they agreed to it because they wanted him back on their show. So it also shows that you can do that thing on your own, but you might tend to just be reaching the same audience and they'll probably dwindle over time. It's helpful to go on a platform like HBO, reach a wider audience and bring new people to the next time you do something on your own like that. So, you know, he's got old concerts available as audio only downloads. He's got this show that'll be available a few months after it airs on HBO. He isn't abandoning his entrepreneurial ways. He's just seeing the value of a platform like HBO.
Well, Karen, thank you very much. That's our last story. That's our last big deal, big whoop story. I know.
No, don't go.
I know. I miss you guys.
Well, thanks for coming by. It was a lot of fun. It was the best big deal, big whoop ever.
I should come, like, I join the show at least once a month.
Yes.
To do big deal, big whoop. We'll have to get you another headset, though.
What's the matter with this one? It's not good.
It makes that
it's
little...
expensive.
Oh, really? It makes that little, like, electronic buzz.
Oh, it doesn't?
Yeah, which I think may be your computer or your headset. And I know that our listeners are truly interested in all of this.
And you know they are.
Absolutely.
Well, it was good talking to you. And I know you've got a meeting in a minute, but thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, guys.
Talk to you soon.
Bye. It was great to have Karen here.
Yeah, no, it's always great to have her back. And I especially like the way you guys always agree on Big Deal, Big Whoop. Actually, I think today you did agree. So I don't know what
I wonder what you would have thought about Inside Baseball.
Well, Inside Baseball, just for those of you who don't know, is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this week, it really does affect our listeners because 3D and Blu-ray and HTV are surging. The sales are off the charts. Okay, Michael, why don't you explain what this is all about?
Okay. This is a report from a newsletter that I get, an email newsletter called Hollywood in High Def. It's a cheerleader of sorts for 3D, Blu-ray, and HD television. Scott Hetrick is there. He wrote an article that I read, and he was talking about some of the good news for people who are enthusiastic about 3D and high def. 3D compatible TV sales will reach 5.5 million units this year. That's more than double the total of 2011 when they sold 2.7 million units. That's according to the Consumer Electronics Association, the CEA. Next year in 2013, they think they're going to sell 8 million units. With the addition of Iron Man 3 and Thor 2, more than 40 movies will be released in 3D in 2013. Worldwide, there are some 35,000 screens that are available for 3D movies. And he says that more than 200 3D Blu-ray titles are now available. I mock that by saying that because 200 is such a small number. But nonetheless, there are 200 3D Blu-ray titles available. YouTube offers 3D for 20,000 videos. 3D video on demand is available in at least some form from providers like Time Warner, Comcast, DirecTV, and others.
Well, you know, for a guy who hates 3D, you sure are saying it a whole heck of a lot.
I am. And I don't hate 3D. I hate paying a premium for 3D. That's okay. What I hate. And I don't think 3D on TV works very well. But I hate paying a premium. If a movie should be made in 3D and they want to, great. Most of the time, it's just an add-on to charge extra money. And half the time, they slap it on after the movie's made.
Can I just point something out? Just because a TV is 3D compatible doesn't mean, or capable, whatever they're calling it, doesn't mean...
Exactly. This is the cheerleading portion of the segment. As for high def in general, we'll get to our analysis in a second.
Oh, okay.
He says high def TVs can be found in 100 million homes in the U.S. Blu-ray players can be found in 50 million homes. Sales of Blu-ray discs are up 12% in the third quarter. They've risen every quarter for the past 2 years. And in an age when DVD and Blu-ray sales in general are declining, that means Blu-ray is more than holding its own. So, wow, what great news. Isn't that terrific? So why is the headline of the story that he wrote, 3D grows deceptively strong? Because, of course, as Sperling's about to point out, they're putting the rosiest spin on the facts possible. They're saying it may look like 3D has proven a fad yet again, but in fact, it's here to stay. Well, here's a reality check. Sperling?
Well, it's kind of like saying, spare tire comes with car. You know, it's like, so all of these devices, whether it's a Blu-ray player, a TV, they're all going to be 3D compatible now, because if you're not 3D compatible, then you're selling obsolescence effectively. So people are buying them, but they're not necessarily using that technology.
I'd say it's even worse than saying, a spare tire with a car, because a spare tire is something you want and something you're going to almost, likely use at some point. And so it's an essential item. I'd say 3D is more like some gizmo on your car that you're never going to use. You know, that's the point. Yeah, the TVs are 3D compatible, but how many people are buying, three or four or five sets of 3D glasses and watching 3D material on their TV? Very few, I imagine. I don't know anyone who has a 3D compatible TV and actually uses it.
I've seen one or two people use it, but then it's like, but here's how it's used. It's usually at a party, and usually it's like, oh, we have like two pairs of 3D glasses, and everybody watches, Shrek or whatever DVD that they happen to have that's 3D. They'll watch like 5 minutes of it wearing the glass and be like, cool, your turn, and like hand the glasses over to somebody else so that they can see what it's like. And then nobody actually sits through the whole movie.
Right. Not that they would at a party, but probably don't do it a lot at home anyway. And of course, people with 3D compatible televisions have very little to watch. They can buy one of those 200 Blu-ray discs, which is a pathetically small number given the library of movies and television.
Well, but digital 3D is, it's a fairly new technology, so...
No, 3D has been around since the 50s, but it's a fad and it keeps falling apart. So there's not a lot of programming.
Digital 3D is what I'm saying. Digital 3D.
Well, there was one 3D cable channel called N3D, and they were around the Olympics, and they stopped creating original programming after the Summer Olympics in London.
Right. But they were put together specifically for the Summer Olympics. So,
right. So if you have a 3D compatible TV and you spend hundreds of dollars to buy glasses and you want to watch some 3D television, if you turn it on, it's not there. There's no new original programming. There's another 3D channel called 3Net, which is backed by Sony, Discovery, and IMAX. And they said, we're going to start doing original programming soon. So again, there's very little for you to watch on those 3D TVs. Hey. And as far as I'm concerned, at the movies, people do not want to pay 3D. They are rejecting 3D at the movies.
Well, there are, 40 more additional movies coming to a theater near you next year.
That's right. Studios have a ton of films in the pipeline, but attendance is clearly shifting away from 3D week by week and month by month. 2D screenings are more popular for all but a few movies every year. Some fans are forced to buy 3D tickets, but I don't think they're happy about it. I think 3D in the movie theater is a novelty. If you look at the 40, I think it's 47 movies that are listed. That's the last movie is 47 Ronin. That's why I thought it was 47 movies. But there are more than 40 movies coming out next year. Texas Chainsaw 3D, Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, Jack the Giant Slayer, G.I. Joe Retaliation, Jurassic Park reissue in 3D, Star Trek Into Darkness, the new Star Trek movie, The Great Gatsby, Iron Man 3, on and on and on. You can look through the whole year and see all the movies coming out on 3D. I would say of all of them, I would want to pay maybe to see Star Trek Pacific Rim, that's the movie by Guillermo del Toro, and the second edition of The Hobbit. I'd maybe want to see those in concert. And of course,
in concert,
I'd want to see those in 3D, as well as, of course, One Direction in concert. That 3D concert film, I don't want to miss that at all. But all those other movies, I have no interest in seeing Thor in 3D. I have no interest in seeing Sin City.
What about Iron Man 3, Monsters University, is the Monsters
Inc. No. If somebody put out a review and said, oh my gosh, this 3D is, stunning, and this movie is so worth seeing in 3D, you don't want to miss it, then maybe I would be convinced to see one of the others. Or if I saw a review of Star Trek or Pacific Rim that said, don't bother with 3D, that would make me not want to bother with it. But the last time I remember hearing a movie was so good in 3D, I had to see it that way, was Avatar. No movie since then.
What about The Great Gatsby?
I think, as a critic, I have to see it in 3D, but I'm not interested in seeing it. I don't want to pay to see it, and I'm not excited to see it in 3D. It seems completely pointless for a movie like that, though that's the whole point. Can he make it important to see this movie, a drama, in 3D? That makes it significant for me as a critic to go, but I'm not excited by it, and I don't want to pay for it. What about you? Do you want to pay to see it? There's 40 movies. You want to go every week?
Some no.
The vast majority, yes or no?
No. I mean, Texas Chainsaw 3D, I'm not going to see the movie in
the first place. Well, no, a movie you want to see. It has to be, first, we got to say it's a movie you want to see.
Okay, The Great Gatsby, I'd pay to see in 3D.
Oz, The Great and Powerful?
Depends on the review. Depends on how they use it.
Well,
Monsters University? Yeah, I'll pay to see that in 3D. Pacific Rim, as you said? Yes. The Smurfs 2? Absolutely not.
Do you think most people are excited to pay every week they go to movies to pay an extra $2 or $3 to see a movie in 3D?
Again, I would have to say absolutely not.
Yeah. So I think if this 3D is a good attraction, just like widescreen, just like color, just like sound, if the movie should be seen in 3D, they should be thrilled. We're still paying to go to the movies to see them, and they should be happy to give it to us for free.
You know what makes me thrilled and happy, actually? When we get email from our listeners and voicemails. Yes, yeah, some of them email us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that is exactly what Gary Webster did this week.
Tell us what he said.
Well, he says, hi, Sperling and Michael. First, I love Showbiz Sandbox.
Gary.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, well, it gets even better. He says, along with Framerate, which is a show over on the This Week in Tech, the Twit Network, he says, along with Framerate, Showbiz Sandbox is a must podcast for me. So thank you so much. That actually made my entire month. I had some thoughts on episode number 169, which was our previous episode from last week. I really enjoyed the segment on DVR recordings and how they are reflected in the ratings. One day, 3 days. I believe that I'm in a growing number of people who will never be reflected by those measurements. And by the way, Gary, what I'm about to... I am in your camp here. He says, I record many, many shows, but except for a select few like Breaking Bad, I don't feel compelled to watch them in a hurry. Most of the shows that I record on my DVR, no matter if it's HBO, Showtime, AMC, or network offerings, they live on my DVR for a much longer time. I'm usually about a year behind. And
how can they have room for them all?
Well, he gets to that later. By the way, and Gary, I'm still watching Lost, okay? The ending of Lost, so I'm like 3 years behind. He says, I consume a lot of media, Blu-rays and DVDs, books, video games, also a number of podcasts and streaming through Roku and Apple TV. Plus, during baseball season, I subscribe to the MLB TV package. Are you looking for a roommate? That's what I want to know. So my TV shows, they just stack up. I love Game of Thrones, but I'm just now getting started on season 2. I like to view shows this way because I always have something good to watch. The only downside is the occasional spoiler I hear, which is why I walk around with headphones on all the time, by the way. My point is, I know it doesn't help advertisers any, but networks need to find a way to measure viewers like me to determine if a show is a hit. An example, Fox had already canceled Alcatraz before I even got around to watching it.
You should be thanking them, Gary.
Well, he says, I thought it was pretty good.
Oh.
I had recorded the whole season. People are also doing the same thing with Netflix and Hulu. Well, Hulu Plus. Watching the entire season without waiting week to week. It's all part of the changing TV landscape. Sincerely, Gary Webster. And hats off to you, Gary, because you know what? You sent this from your iPad. So you sent that long email.
This is a tech-savvy fella.
Yeah. You asked how he has room for all that. He is a Dish customer, and his hard drive on his DVR is pretty big. He says it holds 80 hours of HD programming.
Still.
And still not enough. He holds. He has a terabyte external hard drive hooked into the DVR. I'm telling you, if he's looking for a roommate, I'm your man.
How do you hook up an external terabyte hard drive? I wonder if I can do that with my DVR.
I believe, well, I know with TiVo you can.
Well, I don't have TiVo.
Okay.
I have Time Warner Cable. So, Gary, look into it. No, no, thank you very much for writing. That's fascinating. Yeah, TV networks need to catch people like Gary. Obviously, if you wait 6 months or a year to watch a show, you're really breaking their hearts, Gary. You got to be a little quicker on the ball for new shows or they won't last. But, you know, that's, you know, 7 days is not unusual. A week or two? Come on. Sometimes I want to watch 2 or 3 episodes at a time. Or I fall behind and I missed out on Breaking Bad. So now I'm stuck. I'm waiting for the DVDs to come out because I somehow got lost in the middle of the season. And I don't know why, but an episode or two didn't record. I lost track of it. And I said, you know what? I just want to start from the beginning and watch it all at once on DVD. So that's where I'm at with Breaking Bad. And this is happening a lot for a lot of different people. You know, and they want to make sure they cover everybody that's watching. So they need to track us better.
Of course, if you'd like to send us your comments, you can do so, as I mentioned, at dirt@showbizsandbox.com, D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information, as well as links to all of the stories we talked about on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us, you can follow us on Twitter. Or on Facebook, you can, I guess, follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Our username at both social networking sites is ShowbizSandbox. Of course, all of that information is on our website, ShowbizSandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher. And we request or suggest or
beg.
We beg you to please subscribe to the show and or rate and review it on any one of those podcast aggregators or anywhere where podcasts are given away for free. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz, besides showbizsandbox.com, you have your own website. It is?
michaelgiltz.com.
And that's where some of your writing can be found. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Now, just a reminder, we're going to be taking Thanksgiving week off here in the U.S. and be back not next week, but 2 weeks from now. So until 2 weeks from now, play nice.